like this works, I'm always just so impressed
now,
and relieved.
Today is so much simpler. Some days when I'm in the recording booth upstairs, right now I just have it looped through my downstairs recording system, but when I'm in the booth upstairs, the old school recording studio has not a rotary phone, but like an old school phone. So I have to conference call from the radio station lobby, transfer it to the studio, pick it up on the soundboard, and talk through a microphone. It is like, it is a time.
Yep.
So in any case,
wow.
Well, thank you both for your time. I know it's a crazy time of year. I know we're in so many time zones. I can't even. Joe, you're Eastern, right?
Yeah.
I think this is the first interview I've done. Oh, no. I've done one interview in three time zones. It was with Lauren Heller at Delaware and Danielle Gaudry in California.
So this is definitely like transnational, at least.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. Before we go any further, I just want to ask real quick. I think I sent this in the email, but I will type all this out and sort of produce the episode and then send it back to you so that you're able to proof it, so you don't feel like I took anything out of context. But to do that, I have to ask if it's okay if I record our phone conversation. Joe, is that okay with you?
No. Yes. Yes. Okay.
Eric, is it okay if I record our phone conversation?
Yes, it is.
Great. Well, again, I'm thrilled to have you both now that we're recording and it's official. I thought before we jumped in any further, if both of you could do about, I don't know, like a minute or two introduction about who you are, just to give the listener a little bit of background. How about, Eric, we go with you first?
Oh, okay, sure. So my name is Eric Leung, and I am currently the director of bands and department chair here at Fresno Pacific University. I graduated from Northwestern with Mallory Thompson as my teacher, and prior to that, I went to school in Toronto and Calgary. This is my fifth year here at Fresno Pacific.
I'm wondering, what class does everyone at Northwestern take to be the department chair? Because there are about 1,000 of you now.
we all leave with some kind of control complex.
Travis is the chair. You're the chair. Gerard Morris is the chair. There's so many of you. Well, that's great.
I'm happy to announce I am the chair of no one. I'm not.
You're very lucky.
You are the high chair. The high chair.
Yeah.
Joe, how about we kick it to you? Could you give the listeners some info about you?
Sure. So, Joe Higgins, I'm from Georgia. Came up in the rich band state of Georgia. I went to the University of Georgia for my undergrad and taught high school band in Gwinnett County. And then did my master's and doctorate at Northwestern with Dr. Thompson. And had a couple of years there with now Dr. Leung. And I've been 4 years at Rowan University here in New Jersey, where I am now. So in my eighth semester, I'm director of bands, not department chair. I teach conducting, teach graduate conducting, and conduct the wind ensemble. And our new ensemble, the symphonic band, that started today, very exciting. And we also have a concert band. So, making things happen here in New Jersey.
That's great. Well, I look forward to all that you both have to contribute, and I'm interested to hear your thoughts on some of these questions. So I think we'll just jump right in. The first question I posed for everyone on these panels is, do you think that band conductors from the early 20th century would recognize our ensembles today? And is that a good or a bad thing? Joe, how about we go to you first?
Cindy Johnson Turner, who's at UGA, I've heard her say a couple of times when she's doing honor bands that if someone from 100 years ago plopped up here in 2019, where are we? If someone appeared here from 100 years ago, they would, you know, not recognize being in a hospital, and they probably wouldn't recognize being in a middle school. They wouldn't recognize being in most places. But if they appeared in the middle of an ensemble rehearsal, very little will have changed. I think if they were an orchestra member from 1900 and they arrived in an orchestra today, they would be very comfortable and know exactly what was happening, probably what piece you're playing, and you know, what's expected of them, what the tone and tenor of the room is going to be. And I'm not quoting her. That was a very much a paraphrase. But I've heard her say that, and it's true. Had me thinking. I think it's when you say it like that, it's presented as if that's a bad thing. And I'm of the mind that, you know, I don't think tradition is necessarily bad, but I agree with her that we definitely need to think creatively about how we're supposed to create art and make music for the world in 2019. Kind of all about priorities.
Great. Yeah. Eric?
You know, I fully agree with Joe. I think there's a lot of things that, you know, people would see that are similar. I think for me, I guess the best way to think about it would be that there's like echoes of the things that have come before us. You know, I think we've been really lucky that we've had teachers of teachers of teachers, you know, where we can trace our lineage to, you know, Frederick Fennell or Donald Hunsberger or Mr. Painter or Ray Kramer. And so I think that we in the 21st century kind of carry forth that idea. But I think that there are some things that have changed. I think you're going to find a lot more, especially in like the professional orchestras now, especially with like the rise of blind auditions, you're going to see a lot more women, you know, in roles, leadership roles in an orchestra. You're going to see a lot more women conductors, women composers. And I think that may be like just more of an evolution of what was started, you know, 100 years ago. But I would definitely think that there are the echoes of what has come before us. It's probably the best way I can think about it. So.
Yeah. Well, and Joe, it's funny that you brought that up. I had the opportunity to visit with Cynthia Johnson Turner just a couple weeks ago, and she brought up that very same thing, like that idea of transport. If someone just showed up, it certainly would feel quite similar, and I had never really considered that. And yeah, I mean, it's absolutely true.
I think we tend to think that, of course, things are changing. You know, like I don't think like my parents thought,
right?
And, you know, they don't think like the previous generation thought. But I think it's very easy to come up in a tradition and not really know what parts are intrinsic to what you're doing, like what parts of being an ensemble musician are completely necessary, what parts of the role of a conductor are completely necessary, and what could potentially be upended or abandoned, what could be revolutionized. And so I think today you do have a lot of changes. I think you have some people who are more, you know, maybe more than others, which is, it shouldn't be everybody, or we would kind of lose our center. But you do have some people more than others who are really experimenting and trying new fun ways of doing things. And thanks to social media and podcasts and whatnot, people are sharing those ideas. And so that's all really exciting, as people are maybe being a little more critical in the good way.
Yeah. It's great.
You're here.
It's awesome. Eric, we'll jump to you first on this next one. And again, I think one of the things about these questions is that everyone has sort of their own idea to interpret them. So you take us whatever way you would like to. But how important is selecting meaningful repertoire for our ensembles?
Well, I guess the obvious answer would be very important.
Correct.
Question number 3. Let's move on.
But, you know, to expand on that, I think, you know, the repertoire, you know, as I talk to my grad students, my own students in the undergrad classes, that it really serves as like the diet, you know, for our ensembles. You know, I'm lucky that we have wonderful colleagues here at our university, and I know some colleagues that can select have selected the same textbook each semester, you know, and so there's like that consistency of having a common textbook each semester. I don't think in our field we have that luxury. You know, where we can, you know, do Holst every single semester, or Granger, the same piece of Granger every single semester. We kind of have to change it up. We're forced to change it up, you know, and that's the nature of our profession. And I think because of that, it's really made us cognitive of making sure that we don't take the responsibility lightly of selecting repertoire. You know, and for me, I think it's really important to select quality repertoire, but also to make sure that the music has, you know, both intrinsic value to myself and to my students, but also has the ability to teach meaningful concepts. You know, for us here at Fresno, we are a teaching university. You know, a lot of our students are music ed majors, and so I'm really conscious of selecting music that educates them and that kind of informs their taste, so that when they go off and select repertoire, they're keeping these kind of things that I've shown them in mind as well. So.
Yeah, that's great. And Joe?
I agree with all of that. Maybe to, since I didn't really prepare these questions, maybe
which
to take it
totally
in a slightly
fine.
Different direction. When I, you know, how important is selecting meaningful repertoire? I think repertoire selection as an expression of values. And I think that's been helpful for me lately. Because there are so many factors you could consider, and I don't want to leave any of those factors out. Whether it's, you know, I'm thinking about my students, that they're interacting with composers who have also written music at other levels that they may be able to perform with their students. I want to perform, you know, you want to perform new pieces and canonic pieces. I value, you know, repertoire by a diverse pool of applicants, so
sure.
That's a factor. And you write all these factors down, and I think it can be overwhelming, but I think that is a process well worth going through. This is, you know, our most important, one of our most powerful tools as a conductor in expressing our values is this repertoire selection. So, you know, I would say write down all of the factors and then look at them and decide what's most important to you. And again, it's about priorities. So if certain factors are, or elements are going to be a priority for me, then I kind of can start there. I think, you know, I personally used to be beholden to starting with the canon works, and then like that was my project piece, and then I would build around it, and that's where I could choose some new pieces that would be kind of unoffensive. And I've since maybe, I think I still choose pieces from all those categories, but I've definitely shifted my priorities to different areas, and even different areas for different concerts. I agree, like you said, every piece needs to be of high quality, but I definitely I free myself from putting quality first, because that kind of had me stuck in a rut of having to program around the big pillar, scary piece, and it's been kind of liberating. To I did Linkage Posey last semester, so you know, still play the pieces, but you know, it came. But even that piece, and I can talk about that later. But even programming that piece came about in a really different way than it would have a few years ago when I kind of was starting with, you know, what's the really, really good piece that I'm going to choose?
Yeah.
And just focusing on kind of traditional, you know, value of how respected is the piece.
Yeah.
That's no longer always first.
Yeah. That's a really interesting concept. I like that, the values thing. That's very cool. I think we can just, Joe, I'm going to stick with you for a second. You mentioned something about canonic works, and the next question kind of segues nicely. How do you approach programming and conducting music outside the canon?
Oh, with passion. I do my best to approach it with, you know, with as much enthusiasm and wonder and potential as if it was the Hindemith Symphony or any, you know, whatever your favorite, if you like Holzer Suite, whatever your favorite thing is. I try to approach them all with that much enthusiasm. I think there are a lot of, as more and more people are discussing this, I've heard a lot of different approaches to for example, let's say you want to program more women composers, outside of the canon, since there are few works by women in the quote-unquote canon at this time. So you could put, you know, one piece by a woman on every concert, that approach. And you could program a concert of all music by women composers. I think, you know, either things good and bad about both of those, but I think there's great value in all of it. If it means something to you, if you do it with intention and you have a reason, then that'll be infectious, I think, for all the players, and then that'll be live for your audience, and they'll buy it, and they won't worry about whether or not it was in the canon. Another thing, it's kind of a different way to answer the question, but I've been thinking a lot recently about how to balance concerts, and when I look at concert programs for bands, they started to all really look the same. There's whether it's in their form of like an opener, and there's probably a slow piece, and there's probably an evocative kind of newer piece, and there's probably a masterwork, and there's probably a concerto. And I think it's a good form to have all those pieces in there. And there's probably, you know, a piece by whatever, different types of people. I think the danger for me is that every concert just kind of starts to feel the same. And what has re-energized a lot of programs I've seen from colleagues around the country that got me really excited is people programming without complete balance on every concert. So some programs are a little out of balance, but over the course of the year, it might be really balanced repertoire. So like what I've been thinking of is balance the year and not the concert. And that too has freed me up from feeling so much like, oh my God, I just went 3 concerts and didn't play Granger. Well, maybe on the next one, I'll do 4 pieces by Granger. And if you do that with intention and there's a reason, it could end up being even more meaningful. Like this, that really like in-depth foray into Granger, that could be really, like that's what we recently did at Rowan. And it was insanely fun and memorable. And in the end, I think we learned a little bit more about Granger than we would have with one of those pieces on each of 4 programs.
Got it.
So that's another way I've approached programming music outside the canon, is not worrying about spreading it out. Like if I have an idea and I think these 3 pieces work great together, great. We'll check other important boxes later. But you know, many of us have the luxury of having the same students for years. And so, you know, I kind of assume I'll have a student for at least 4 semesters. And so I'll balance those 4 semesters.
Got it.
That makes sense.
Cool.
You're here.
Eric, talk to me about how this might apply at your program in California. How do you approach programming and conducting music outside the canon?
I'm just going to jump off, with something that Joe was saying, and which is the idea of kind of programming and not being so beholden to like a specific concept or a format for programming. And it's really, really interesting what Joe was talking about, that he was like kind of, you know, struggling with this, because I've been doing the same thing. And lately, what I've been thinking about more of is that the concert becomes more of an experience and less of a concert. And so there's more engagement from the audience rather than just kind of sitting there taking in the music. But we can talk more about this, you know, later on. But how do you make a concert experience something worthwhile, you know, for our audience to invest in, for our students to invest in? And I think that's something that's changing. And I've read these awesome articles from the New York Times talking about how the New York Phil has been moving locations, you know, for their concerts. And because of these change in venues, it's forced them to think about the concert experience in a different way, rather than just sitting down and just taking in the music. But kind of like on, that's kind of a tangent for me.
Yeah.
But I think just like back to your question, I to be honest, I really think that we as wind band conductors weighed down by, you know, hundreds of years of canon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like our orchestral colleagues or even our choral colleagues, you know, like Mozart didn't write a lot for us. You know, we didn't have a lot of operas, or, you know, Palestrina didn't write anything for us. And so yeah. I feel like we don't have that kind of obligation. You know, we can go back, you know, about 100-150 years or so, but we don't have a huge amount of repertoire that we can choose from, and I think that's helped us be more daring.
Yeah.
In our repertoire. And just listening to what Joe was saying, you know, I think it's that kind of daringness that has helped us be more, I guess, cognitive of trying to seek out new composers, new kind of ways to do the same kind of concert experience. So I think that's been a really liberating experience, at least for me, as a teacher, as a conductor of band.
Yeah. Now, Eric, when you talk about that, I'm interested. Do you, and I think Joe mentioned this as well, so it could be either of you, but there, when you think about this sort of idea as like a concept for a concert, or I think, Joe, you mentioned like you had a couple pieces that really go well together, thinking about that overall arching experience, does that begin to take the lead in the way you sort of sell maybe a newer piece to your ensemble, or are you in rehearsals working on this new piece, they've experienced it for a while, and then sharing with them maybe what your overarching idea for this concert is? Do you know what I mean? Which way do you start?
It certainly isn't always one way. But it has become more and more, it starts and they have a pretty good idea of what these pieces have in common or what the general idea is. So more and more I tend towards that, where the big idea, or at least one of the threads,
got
is
it.
Right there on my sleeve. It's on your syllabus.
Got
it's
it.
In the concert promotion. And I become more and more overt for a couple of reasons. I think, one, I'm trying to have a conversation with the students about that thing. So,
right.
For example, we're doing a climate change cycle right now. So it started out, this one started out because I wanted to do Sally Lane McCune's High Water Rising. Back to Cynthia Johnson Turner. This is unrelated, but I saw her conduct that piece. She's my favorite conductor ever, evidently. I saw her conduct that piece with an intercollegiate band, and it's great. It's kind of beautiful, naturalistic at the beginning and end, and it is turbulent, and it's not too explicitly about anything. But with the title High Water Rising, it for me was very evocative of, sea level changing and the need for climate action, or it really inspired those feelings in me. And I like the sounds, and I really love this part with trombone glisses. So anyway, I was excited to do the piece. And in putting it different places on our program, as I was working with that, last year, that was when U.S. pulled out of the Paris Agreement. And
okay.
So I started to think about, I was reading articles coming out around that time about the artist's role in climate change and climate action. And so, you know, I was thinking about ways that I could take that conversation to my students. And the way I interact with them is with an ensemble. And so it all kind of spawned from, I wanted to be able to, you know, through music, have this conversation with them of like, what is the artist's role in climate action? And looking forward, so it's less about what should be done about climate action, and our conversation is a bit more what is the musician's role. And that's a really interesting discussion, and a lot of smart people have had a lot to say about that recently, and this has been how we've interacted with it, is with the program. So I would say that idea kind of came to light, programmed the concert, put that piece on there, and then I built the program with that inspiration. Now, many pieces on a program may not be explicitly connected at all. And so for those pieces, like we're doing, we're doing Eric Whitaker, Luke's, on this concert. How that piece connects for me may not be exactly how it connects for one of my students.
Got it.
And so that could be something that we discover throughout the process in a series of conversations that just kind of happen organically during rehearsal.
Got it. And Eric, you were kind of, it sounds like you're agreeing in some ways. Is that sort of similar for you as you sort of imagine how the concert will unfold as a whole? You share that with them early on, and then maybe other threads develop kind of as it moves along?
Yeah, I think a lot, kind of like what Joe was saying, I think maybe just for me, Joe is way smarter than I am.
our responses during this questioning reveals something different. and you're much more prepared.
Well, I would say that Joe is much more methodical about thinking about programs than I am. To be honest, sometimes we have obligations. So for instance, we're always involved in consortiums and commission projects and stuff like that. And so for this cycle, we had a whole bunch of music that we had just commissioned, and we were kind of responsible to play. And so for our most current program, our composition professor just wrote a concerto for our group, and so we have to play that. We had just commissioned, we're on the consortium for Medlenka's last symphony. So that's on the program. And so I think for us, as much as I love to have these kind of interconnected programs, for me, sometimes there's the obligation of we have a piece to premiere.
Right.
We have a piece that we have to just, put out to the world. I think in the summers, as I'm, having these times to kind of develop my concert program, I will find more connected threads. But at least to be honest, in this most current upcoming cycle, it is the obligation of having, okay, we have a premiere and we have to play it. And so I feel a little less prepared than Joe about this question.
No, I think, not at all. I think that there's room for everything. And really, I think there's some innovative ways we can approach pieces in the canon, too.
Yeah.
And even if, I think concert theme is like one really useful tool that I am in the middle of, like, all in at the moment. But that, I think I will look back on myself a few years from now, and this will be a tool. But right now, I'm just having a lot of fun with my students exploring it. I'm self-aware enough to realize that I probably tilted a little bit into the crazy arena of how thematic the programs have become.
You're like, I love that yellow bookshelf. It was made in Amish country.
5 minutes later, my house is painted yellow. Yeah. I do tend to explore these things, but
in 2 years, you're gonna have a program titled Toddler Bed.
Oh my word. And for the listeners out there, I just had a baby, and so something exciting about the themes, thinking about my students, is, and this I think could be done without the theme, but I've discovered it through the theme, and I'm excited to do it with maybe a more traditional concert, is involving them in a lot of decisions about how we should communicate with the audience and the overall feeling of the performance and things like that. When there's a theme, there's an easy way to kind of put artistic intent behind every decision. We've done concerts. We did like a rock protest song inspired show, and we had alternative attire, right? We all wore like rock t-shirts with a black jacket. And that's a very small thing that energized a lot of the students around this idea. In each cycle, there's been something like that. And it could happen, though, around a piece. It could happen around a student suggestion. It could happen around the time of year. There are plenty of ways to engage them, like making decisions with artistic intent about all these little things. Like, do we put program notes or do we not? And why? And like having those discussions, since so many of them are going to be you know, professional musicians, having those discussions is really valuable. Yeah. And I've just discovered all the possibilities of things you can make creative decisions about by having a very fixed theme. And so, you know, when we did a concert recently with, we had Viet Quang come in and we played Sound and Smoke, and there wasn't a theme. The thing was Viet Quang's coming because he's currently going to Curtis and we can afford him because that's in town. So the theme was, you know, soft, but we still found ways to make cool artistic decisions about a variety of extra musical things. And that affected the music. It affected how we played it. It affected how it was heard. So that's been kind of an exciting result, unexpected result.
Got it. Well, I feel like we're really in-depth, actually, in the fifth question already, which basically is, what is your impression of students in your ensemble and their performance of this non-canonic repertoire? And do they see it as innovative or something else? And from what I'm hearing from you, Joe, especially, and I'll be interested, Eric, what your thoughts are too, is that the more you've involved them, the more sort of payoff in the end it really has been. With and it sounds like you want to explore more in their contribution.
Yeah, and I think maybe that's one way we can, and I need to, you know, keep pushing myself. I'm also maybe talking about it a lot because I'm thinking about this week getting started. I want to make sure that it stays a student-centered and student-energizing process. I think it's true for a lot of college students that almost every piece they get is a whole new world. and at least for a lot of my students, they don't have a ton of experience with a lot of the pieces in the canon either. So it's really I've had to spend a significant amount of time providing context for every piece. And if it's Ligeture Poesy, it's providing that context of not just, hey, now you need to sit up. This piece is important, boys and girls. No, but you know, a context, maybe look at Granger with a 2019 point of view, and maybe in some way that I was never taught about Granger. And so in that way, because you present music to the students always thoughtfully and with a modern lens, then I think they ingest, whether it's an old piece or a new piece, I think they take it all in the same, you know, with an eager ear and interested to dig in and do it well. It kind of normalizes all of it.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I think, Eric, you and I have talked before, spoke on other time about the diversity of your students and same sort of thing, that there's not a huge canonic knowledge upon entering. So to some extent, I think our conversations are sort of centered around that. Do you find that they find value, your students in particular, in this new approach to programming, or maybe with the theme, is there more for them to grab onto? Or like you said, sometimes you're just under the gun and you have to play certain things.
You know, I think for my kids, they kind of know when they're playing quality repertoire.
Right.
You know, like they intrinsically know, this piece is not as good, you know, and this piece is a great piece. You know, I try to avoid those kind of moments where they're like, this is not a good piece of music.
It happens.
Yeah, it does happen. It's true. But I think for us, you know, like, the idea that the students are invested when they love it, is much easier when we have great music for them. You know, our last concert season, we did two pieces by Jill Puckett, and they loved it. You know, it was this kind of new sound that they'd never heard before, and we decided to pair it with the Gershwin Rhapsody in Blue.
Oh, lovely.
And it was just like this kind of eye-opening experience, because it was, like, for us, it was about the American experience and how you had a composer, you know, that's still living, and then a composer that passed away, but had, like, you know, little tangents, you know, that connected each one of them, these little threads.
Great.
And I think for my students, it was, the concept wasn't this, a very, you know, overt kind of concept, but they understood that there was a thread that, you know, connected it. And I think for them, when they play the Gershwin, when they play, you know, the Puckett lullaby, they realize that, wow, this is the music of their time, and this is the music that if they walk out of our band room and they listen to, you know, the choir sing Brahms, you know, that there's still some weight to it.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, kind of going back to what Joe was saying with the student-centered approach to it, I think it's really important because, you know, I think that at least because of, you know, a large kind of school band movement where maybe some school bands play, you know, insufficient repertoire, not insufficient, but like lackluster repertoire.
Sure.
That the band can become like kind of a second class citizen and they play, you know, schlocky arrangements of orchestral pieces or, you know, they play watered down pieces that maybe don't hold a candle to the orchestral repertoire or the choir repertoire. That I think that, you know, and Joe kind of talked about this, but we need to make sure that we have, you know, pieces that our students can really invest in and really take their teams.
Yeah,
and as you know, back to the repertoire selection being your values, you're sharing those values with your students. So, like Eric's saying, when he chooses, when he programs pieces by, you know, living composers and invites them to Skype in, or, you know, I know you had Jennifer Jolly in recently. Is that true? Or did I make that up?
We had her live. It was really nice.
Yeah. So, you know, a student in his ensemble probably has an experience like that every year. It's not going to be this super innovative thing, which is amazing. It's going to be normal. And
right.
So when his student goes out, they'll be like, oh, well, I'm a band director now. I need to engage with this composer. He's alive.
Yeah.
I need to make sure I'm programming women to inspire the, you know, the students, the women students in my ensemble. And I hope that, you know, the next generation, that's, you know, a little more, they expect that of themselves, and they share that value with us, and then they can keep carrying it forward and see the evolution to the next step, you know, whatever.
Yeah, it's so interesting what the students, like you said, what they take as normal. I've been trying to project the score more, because Cynthia Johnson Turner talked about it a lot in an article and a thing that I heard her with, I think the Everything Band podcast, sometime early in the summer or last fall. So I've been trying to do it. Well, this semester we had our first sight read through of the program last Thursday, and you know, it's the read through. I didn't put the score up because we were just going through, and at the end of rehearsal I had several students who were like, hey, we missed seeing the score, to like, you know, ask some questions. And I was like, wow,
yeah,
okay, well,
yeah.
I thought you would be buried, but here you are asking questions. Like,
that's great. Yeah, we've been doing that. It's wonderful.
Yeah. I was also thinking about when you're talking about when students think, oh, this is really a bad piece of music. We have a big high school honor band festival here in February, and we're rehearsing Ecstatic Waters for that concert because, you know, once you add in all the other stuff, like, you know, all these high school kids will go nuts because who's heard of anything like that before?
But
Steve has said this out loud too, so I don't feel bad repeating it, but rehearsing that piece without the electronics is like rehearsing a really bad piece of band music. I mean, there are moments where it's gorgeous and works without the electronics, but then there's stuff that you're just like, we are just working on bizarro technique here that sounds like cacophony. Like, could we get a little bit of an anchor? So I look forward to including that, because I think some of them are looking at me like, Jesus, what did you get us into here? But fortunately, I feel like we've had several programs last fall that they trust me a little bit. So we'll see.
Eric and Trey, what do you guys do when you have programmed a piece that is not great, or that your students don't think is awesome? Like, what do you have strategies? Or
we just did Libby Larson's Short Symphony, which doesn't sound great until the very end. Particularly the middle, there's a four movements, but there's a slow movement in the middle. You know, it was kind of like dragging them to the tomb for a while in the prep. They just didn't get it until the percussion sounds started to click and those sorts of things. And it really took a lot of, like, not overselling. I mean, I don't think I was in any way having to oversell the piece. The piece, I think, is really wonderful and should be played more often. But I think, on the program, it was not as exciting as some of the other stuff started. So I think for me, that was kind of like my own fault. I maybe should have started with it and prepared it sooner and left other things off the docket, because I feel like the other stuff on the program energized faster than it did, you know?
Right. Right.
So I think for me, and again, you know, I think we're all learning in every rehearsal. So for me, you know, in the back of my mind filed away is the next time I do that piece on a program, I've got to make sure that it's in pretty good shape before I, well, not good shape, but I've that it feels good before I move to the next thing, because other things around it will certainly rev up faster. I don't know, Eric. I don't know what your thoughts are there.
You know, to be honest, my experience with it is that we've been really lucky that we've been able to commission a bunch of new music. And sometimes when you get that new piece of music in front of you and you start reading it and you realize, and this is a true story, we realized that it wasn't going to be very good.
Right.
And then you start getting really scared.
Yeah.
And you're like, man, we spent money on this. and I remember one specific rehearsal where I sat down with the kids and I said, this piece is not good, but we have to do our best to make it sound amazing. You know, and so I remember taking inspiration from Dr. Thompson, watching her in one of these rehearsals where she had to like adjust things in the score. And we went through, you know, the music that we had commissioned, and we started adjusting things to make it sound better.
Yeah.
I remember when we brought the composer in, he was like, wow, this sounds great. I was like, yeah, I'm really glad that it worked out then.
I think about her a lot, Dr. Thompson. When I'm working on a piece that is not good, it's usually a concerto because I didn't pick it, or maybe a commission that I decide I want to do even though it's not great. When I'm in those moments, I think about her. A really good lesson that I don't think it was made explicitly, but you know, an inferred lesson was that you should, that like she would never try to sell something she didn't think was good. You know what I mean? She's right. Trusting the players enough to also, like you said, they know. So you're foolish to stand up there and keep hammering away, like convincing them it's a good piece if you don't believe it is. That's different than a piece that you do believe is good and that they don't see it yet.
Right.
I'm talking about a piece that you just don't think is great. So I do always think about her. The lesson there was, you know, you kind of have to be in on the joke a bit. Like, if we're doing this piece, this is why we're doing it, and there has to be value in that. I mean, if there's not even a reason you're doing it, then don't do it. But if there is a reason, there's the there's value in that, and there are still things you can focus on. You know, I find myself saying things like, "All right, now this transition is really, really clumsy. How can we we need to figure out how to make this sound intentional."
Yeah.
And that becomes our challenge, is to make this transition have purpose. And I'm like, wow, we're having to work so hard at this, guys, because it's not written well. So let's try it again. Just keeping them in the same frame of mind. And because it is a good challenge, and it's something that every musician has to, you know, try to create a convincing musical moment out of something that they may not believe in or may not think it's quite, you know, worth it. But
yeah.
You know, that's not too often, but anyway, I always think about Dr. Thompson, who's just like the best at that, and like letting everyone know, like, look, I get it, this is our job, and like getting down to work, and everyone's still really having a positive experience rehearsing it.
Yeah,
there's like a professionalism to it.
Yeah
I like that. Joe, you mentioned, or Eric, Joe, you mentioned that Eric, you just had Jennifer Jolly out. Our next question is, do you have any female or minority composers in mind that more people should be aware of? Maybe pieces you're doing? It's obviously, this is a big topic in some of the things, something going on in our profession, and I think globally, not only with music, but just in general. But I'm interested to know about any music by female composers or maybe minority composers that you've performed recently and you might want to share with others.
Yeah, I mean, do you mind if I just jump in? Or
jump in, Eric. That sounds great.
So I know Joe and I have been, you know, kind of really obsessed with Jennifer Jolly. I think she's awesome. And she's written really cool pieces. I know Joe just did Motordom.
Oh, yeah.
And that's super awesome.
It's very playable.
Yeah, it's a great piece.
Yeah, lots of pieces. Jennifer, I don't mean that as like it's playable. I mean like lots of pieces lots of groups could do that piece.
Cool.
Oh yeah, yeah. But yeah, I think Jennifer Jolly's writing some awesome stuff right now. She's getting a lot of play. I went to school with a composer named Kate Nishimura.
Oh, yeah.
I know her Chasing Sunlight's getting a lot of play lately.
Yeah, we're doing that with our third group. Everyone's playing that piece, every honor band, which is awesome.
Yeah, she's super nice. Really, really cool lady. And there's another person that I recently met. Her name is Nicole Puno.
Yeah.
She's, I think, from Michigan. And Nicole's great, really friendly, and I really like her music. So those would be probably the three people that I know of that are kind of new and upcoming. I guess Jennifer's more established than Kate and Nicole. Yeah.
That's great.
We did Nicole Puno's Autumn Air, premiered that last year, and it's really, really lovely, kind of slow, exciting piece. And if you're, we did not perform it in autumn, but I suppose that would be the time to play it.
Autumn Air and Granger's Harvest Hymn. There you go.
There you go. These things write themselves. let's see. We're doing, I got lots of stuff. Let's see. There's a, trying to think of things that aren't well known. Elena Rasinova Lucas. She has a piece called Harvesting the Fields of Russia that I'm not sure if it's really published anymore, but it's available through her. I think she teaches at NEC, but she has a couple other pieces, including like a multi-movement tribute to Charlie Chaplin. There's video that can go with it, so that's pretty cool. Jennifer Higdon's Mysterium doesn't get played a lot. You know, I think it's mostly a choral work, but the transcription, we did it, and I was, at first I said, oh, this isn't as good as a choral piece. By the end, it was really like a special performance. So I think if you would like to feature, if you like to feature two flute players, you can maybe stage them up front or antiphonally or do something interesting with the flute solos. And it actually, you know, it's a beautiful piece. So people should take a look at that. Libby Larson's An Introduction to the Moon. I mean, whack-a-doodle piece that I think I think everyone should do it because it's phenomenally creative and kind of endlessly, you can just, I would do it and I would not wear like precious gloves. I would get in there and mess it up and figure out how you want to do it. And we like, I brought in my, there's different poetry readings. All the students in our concert band were like reading these different things and voices. And, you know, we had this electric guitar player playing and, my dean, his twin daughters, who are like 5 years old, came in and read one of the poems. I'm a little bit afraid of twins, so it was kind of scary because like the music's really moody, you know, it's creepy. But no, I'm kidding. It was awesome. So that's a piece that's really worth exploring. I think Catherine Saalfelder, all of her music is just so crafty and great. I know a lot of people know about Cathedrals, but it's lots of really awesome music. It's hard.
Really good. Yeah. ASU recorded Crossing Parallels while I was there, and it was more of an experience than I thought.
For a conductor, there's so much to look at.
Oh my
God.
You
know, it's very intellectual pieces, and I mean, they're also musical, but I like that they exist on that level as well.
You're here.
Last person, maybe I'll say Jody Blackshaw. I think more people in the U.S. are familiar with her. I just can't stop programming her Letter from Seda with honor bands.
I've done it several times too.
Yeah, it's wonderful to mix up the rehearsal process by playing a piece like that, especially if you'll do it in the round, like get people up out of their seats. You know, and you can do as much as you want. It's like an Introduction to the Moon. You can do as much as you want with letting students pick things out themselves. Maybe you don't have time for that. And you just want to give them instruction, but it's just teaching them to perform and to make eye contact with a person out in the hall, and you know, be bold. And I'm all about that piece.
That's awesome.
That's probably enough.
These are great people are going to be. I'll be excited to share them.
And it's so exciting. People have all these lists now and databases.
Oh, I know.
I just can't wait till the summer every year to go explore all these lists and like find new things and. Yeah, it's great.
That's awesome. On the next question I have, in fact, I'll just be totally transparent. Question 7, I've taken off the panel just because I think everyone identifies with some sort of imposter syndrome. So we've all just agreed. Everyone that I've talked to in like the first 4 interviews said the same thing, and I was like, okay, we're moving on from this. We're all type A. We're all worried we're not doing enough, and we're all trying to make it happen. So we just, let's move on with our lives. Question 8, we talked a little bit about this, but how do we work to shift the canon towards repertoire that looks more diverse than it currently does without denying the performance of masterworks? And I don't know who wants to jump in there first. Maybe Eric, you want to dive in?
Gosh, yeah.
Because it sounds you're commissioning a lot of music, and sort of maybe you could talk about the balance of all that.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, for me, I really believe in new music. You know, we had an awesome new music group at Northwestern that Joe and I were both TAs for. So I think it really, really kind of colored my perspective of not being afraid of new music. You know, and I also watched, you know, speaking of Dr. Thompson, like, where she would kind of expertly balance, you know, really core repertoire with, you know, just amazing new pieces of music. And so I've really tried to, like, follow that. I know, like, one of the things that, you know, I've been thinking more about is, like, kind of pairing. And you know, speaking of Stephen Bryant, a couple of years ago, we played his Sweet Dreams, and we paired that with the whole suite, and I thought it worked really well, and you know, to doing stuff like that, and we did a concert where we did Elsa's Procession to the Cathedral, and we played Liberation by Baz Lenka, and so we had this kind of concurrent kind of theme of I guess like worship or church. I'm not quite sure what it is, but you know, so we were like trying to like figure out ways that the old can complement the new. And that there's like a way to kind of do that. But you know, I've done a lot of concerts where, you know, all the music is from this year. And I thought, you know, my audience at first, you know, is a little afraid, but I think now that they're used to hearing new music, you know, they're more accepting of it.
Yeah.
And so they're not like, oh, this is music from yesterday kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I think it's approaching the balance of new music and old music, and looking at new music as just, you know, new music, and it's just great music, and we're just going to be excited to play, you know, a piece that no one's ever heard before. And I think the audience and my students really appreciate that kind of energy of playing something brand new. You know, because there's no recordings, there's no one I can phone to ask, like, how did you do this before? You know, I think that's that kind of, like, pioneer spirit that maybe is emblematic of, like, a Californian kind of aspect.
Yeah.
We'll see.
That's great. Joe, any thoughts here?
Yeah, you know, this might be controversial, but...
I love controversial. It's the best part of a podcast.
I guess, you know, does every university need to play every important piece of band music?
You're here.
So, you know, does everyone need to record fill in the blank, the famous piece of band music? I think it's good to do that, and it's good to perform the Hindemith Symphony. But, you know, I'm over it that every university band that can play the Hindemith Symphony needs to do that every 4 years. I liberate myself from that. Now, so that's the controversial statement. Now, you know, I think there are lots of good ensembles now, more than there were 20 years ago.
Yeah.
There are lots of us. There are lots of Dr. Blancos and Dr. Leungs out there who went to excellent schools and have really amazing tastes and know about all these pieces, and we're all really well connected. Now with social media, we're all connected to these composers, and this is where I feel the energy. So I don't feel like I need to pump the brakes on the shift.
Yeah.
Away from masterwork, I don't feel like I need to pump the brakes. I think we can lean in, and we're not going to forget about them. Like, we have lots of recordings, and but there's so many of them, I found myself getting a little bit frustrated with, like, how am I going to show the proper respect to the canon when I want to do all these other things? I don't have enough concerts.
And
so for me, it was about finding the motivation to focus on new music. Like, I don't want, I'm going to keep saying me because I don't want to speak for other people, but lots of people feel this way. I don't want my role to be preserving the great works of band literature. Like, I don't want that to be on my tombstone.
Curator. Right.
I want it to be something like, he was a great dad, and then that he used music to, you know, reflect society and try to engage with ideas and problems, and that he used music to teach his students about what's important, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
And I think one thing, one tool toward doing that is using, is performing masterworks. But, you know, we can't do everything all the time. And so when I read your question about denying the performance of masterworks, I would just challenge anyone in this discussion to not worry so much about denying the masterwork. Like, the masterwork is there, and the new music is there, and I think we should be much more concerned about denying the new music.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. You know, do you mind jump in for a second?
Joe, please,
Trey?
Do, Eric. Please do.
I think, like, with what Joe is saying, it's like, it's really liberating to hear someone say that, you know, not to be so beholden, you know, to do every single masterwork just because you have a band that can. And I think that that kind of train of thinking, or that kind of stream of thought, is really important, because it's liberating. It allows you to think, like, outside of the box. It allows you to try something new and not be afraid to kind of fail.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's really important. I also think that there should be a place, like, we created, like, we have our Chamberlin ensemble that expressly plays, you know, canonic chamber repertoire.
Cool.
And that's all they'll ever do, you know. But I think for them, it's the educational approach of, okay, well, I'm going to be playing in an orchestra one day. I should know the Dvorak Serenade. I should know the Mozart Serenade. And so for us, it's like kind of taking the canon and having it serve a purpose of educating the performers, rather than just justifying the fact that we just should play it.
That reminds me, that, Eric, this should be very different school to school. Like, conductor should really think about, you know, what their job and who's there and what those people need to be prepared to do, and their gifts and what they have to give. And, you know, I completely agree. Like, maybe that chamber group is exactly the right thing. And you got, you know, and maybe the Michigan Symphony Band should play these 37 pieces at least once every 4 years, right? Like, that core rep.
Yeah.
Maybe that should happen. So I guess my whole thing about, does every university need to play every important piece? Maybe some do.
Right.
But yeah, every room is different. If that serves your students, then that is the perfect thing to do. And, you know, at my school, we don't have a contemporary music ensemble. So I kind of make the wind ensemble the contemporary music ensemble, so that everyone in the building, like, is hearing new music, right? And so we've assumed that role. But that might be really different if I was teaching at a different school.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I spoke with two of your other Northwestern colleagues, Trish Cornett, and now at Temple, and Alicia Neal, and their phone conversation was wonderful because they're, you know, they're great friends.
Because they're awesome.
They're great friends, and they're both wonderful conductors. But they both had such different perspectives, because Trish is living in a major orchestral school. I mean, the Philadelphia Orchestra, for God's sakes, teaches at her school.
Right.
So, so she talked about this very same thing that you're talking about, Eric, related to chamber repertoire, that, yeah, her players need to play Dvorak Serenade and Mozart Serenades from time to time. It can't just be about the newest ink. However, finding the balance there, you know, it's all very school related, as she spoke about it too. I like that that mindset.
There's nothing wrong with that. That's our job.
Exactly. We talked about what Cynthia Johnson Turner said our profession, you know, 100 years ago. If you evaporated and showed back up today, it would look the same in the band world. What do you both imagine our profession to look like I don't know, maybe 20 years. What sort of differences or similarities do you anticipate?
Eric, were you about to say something really good? I thought you were.
What an assist. What an assist.
That's called passing the buck, Joe, by the way. what I was going to say was that I've been really listening. I've been listening a lot to the Steve Reich's Four Sections lately. And I've been thinking about, like, is there, like, a fifth section that can be added? You know, and I saw a lot, you know, like, a lot of people are incorporating the electronics into, like, music. And I feel like they're doing it better and better rather than kind of, like, simply overlaying electronics. You know,
oh, yeah.
It's really kind of embedded. And what you're talking about with Static Water is, like, as you said, you know, the piece without the electronics, there's something missing. You know, yeah. It needs the electronics to complete it. Whereas I feel like when early on the electronics are just kind of overlaid, you know, on top of the instrumentalists. But I feel like now that we're starting to see composers get more creative with their thinking with electronics. And I feel like, you know, Jennifer Jolly is another good example where she may not be using electronics like implicitly, but she's thinking about creating effects in a wind band that has that kind of feel to it.
Yeah.
And so I think that you're going to start seeing more and more composers like integrate electronics into the music. You know, we just did last year. We did Deep Field by Eric Whitaker.
Oh yeah.
And it was I didn't think it was going to be very good because it's like 20 minutes of long tones for my kids.
Long.
But he like created the cell phone app at the end of it that had like some visuals and there was no way that my musicians could reproduce what was being played on the cell phone app, and it created this kind of ambient experience when every one of the audience members had their cell phone app playing the app that like really made this incredible experience. And kind of going back to the idea of like experience, you know, I've been thinking a lot about, you know, concerts becoming more experiences and audience members kind of coming into the fold, you know, of a performer, you know, and like maybe they have something to contribute other than just to clap. That's kind of what I've been thinking about lately, but it's probably not narrowed down as much as I'd like.
No, I think that's all very creative. I love the idea of discussion about creativity. My teacher at ASU, Gary, was obsessed with that, and it was some of the best conversations I've had ever, just hearing him talk about those things.
Yeah.
Joe, what about you? Thoughts about down the road, what we look like?
I was enjoying that a lot, and I forgot the question. What our profession looks like.
Yeah, in like 20
you
years.
Know,
let's say 20.
Yeah. So I'll answer in a different way, because that was giving a bit about rep. I dream that our profession is bigger and broader, and that the people who are involved, composers, but really the conductors and teachers and players, represent more diverse populations. I think that is going to take a lot of intentional work, and it won't just happen accidentally. And it's going to take teams of people making change, and there are, you know, interesting ideas expressed about how to get there all the time, and I think all the ideas are good, and we need more ideas and more action, and so I think, you know, 20 years is in some ways a long time, and in some ways, you know, let's really get there. Let's make sure that our field looks different. That'll make it stronger, and which leads me to, I really hope that we're more relevant. You hear a lot, I mean, you've always heard, you know, with music educators that we need to try to be, or have, like, good reasons why it's relevant for being in schools, etc.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think, how do we become relevant? I think we need to be relevant. I think we need to do things that are relevant to the world, and then it will be relevant. seems to be backwards, where it's, you know, how do I convince everybody that what I'm doing is relevant? I think sometimes the better way to look at that would be, what does my community need?
Right.
Or what does my profession need? Or what does, how do I want to address this issue through my profession? And then you can make yourself relevant. So it's a little, I just think we approach that backwards a lot. And so this kind of goes into defying tradition a bit. It kind of circles back around to that, like not to be afraid to really do something bold. And, I mean, are you going to change the world with a concert program? I don't know. You know, maybe. it could be fun to try. And yeah. I hope there are, you know, more people kind of, you know, engaging with those ideas. I think it'll keep us excited and relevant and connected. And, you know, I a person who believes that the world's going to be facing a lot of really big challenges in the next 20, 30 years related to environment and all the social problems that that's going to create. And I don't think that's necessarily going to make music or art less relevant. Okay. I think it could make it more, but I hope that people our age, and like you and me and Eric, like our generation, that we're thinking about that. Yeah. And starting to, you know, lead the conversation about how we want, like how we see the next 20 years of conventions. You know, like right now we're talking about, we seem to be talking about programming more diverse composers, and that is really good. In some ways, that is easier than other changes. Mm-hmm. So I'm interested in us shaping that, us shaping like the next 12 items.
Yeah.
I'm excited about it. I think everything leads me to be, you know, very excited and pleased to be in the profession that I'm in. I feel very lucky.
Yeah, it's great.
You're here.
I can't thank you both enough for your time, and I want to give you an opportunity to maybe share if you have anything. The last question is really about you, and it's, do you have, what type of projects are you working on right now that you might want to share with the listener? Maybe you're working on a transcription or something. Maybe you're working on some new idea with programming. Maybe you're taking your group to tour Hungary next year. I don't know. Any information or projects that you might want to share with the listener? Listeners, I guess I should say listeners. I keep saying listener, like there's going to be one person, my mother, listening to this.
My wife will be a second.
Well, to Mrs. Blanc or whatever your mother's name is, I would say we got lots of fun stuff coming up. This is related to something I said earlier, but the thing that I'm most excited about is creating these thematic programs, and what that's led to at Rowan has been a series for our whole Department of Music. And so what started as a Music of Social Justice concert last year became a Music of Social Justice series for the program, which became a Music of Social Justice series for the department. And so a tiny idea grew into something, you know, much larger than I first imagined. And then, you know, connections were made across campus and across the community in ways that I never saw and I didn't work toward, and people just started coming to us because there's all this, you know, I don't love this word, but synergy around a theme. And that when we were interpreting social justice in the broadest possible sense, and faculty members who I never expected would be excited about this theme, like the most tenured whatever other word I could use to describe, people became very engaged and very, and the students started kind of lighting up in ways that I hadn't seen before. And that is, and a lot of people worked really, really hard to do something exciting. So we've done another theme this year. And so I'm looking forward to what our department might choose to do next year. We might do something with, you know, music and health. We have a new music therapy program, so we could kind of highlight that by talking about music and science or music and healing. There's so many directions. Well, it'll be something very, very broad so that every ensemble is comfortable and engaging with this. But it's become a way to encourage all ensembles and even students during their junior and senior recitals to look at the music that they're playing, be like, is there a way that I could connect with this other bigger conversation through my music? And it really has created a lot of, like, intention behind the kids' programming and the young adults, programming. And
that's cool.
It's really exciting to see, and I'm just psyched about how that's going to evolve, and I would love to, like, share that with people, maybe write it up, figure out a way to share it, and, like, give other people some of the mistakes we made and strategies for, you know, things like that. As it as it's existed for a few years, I might have more ideas about how it can be shared.
Cool. Well, that's really cool.
That's probably it.
Great. Great.
And I'm gonna try to not I'm gonna try to not screw up my baby girl for the next year either. That's my goal, to figure out how to parent.
It's a daily journey, Joe. It's a daily journey, I'm here to tell you. Eric, what about you?
Let's see. We just came off a really busy semester. We were one of the groups at the Western International Band Festival and Band Clinic up in Seattle. So this is kind of a break semester for us. I mean, break in the loosest sense that we're not performing as much as we normally do. As I mentioned, we're working on the Man Like a Symphony, the last one, the 10th one, and it's been really emotional. You know, the kids, most of them were here when David visited us 2 years ago or three years ago. So there's this really, really personal connection to the music that, you know, none of us were really prepared for. And so it's been really interesting playing a piece, you know, that you know was someone's last piece of music. So we've been kind of exploring that a lot, and kind of coming to grips with, you know, like, what does he want? You know, there's no one, he's not here anymore, you know, to tell us what, how to play it. So we are the stewards of his music now. And so it's been this weird kind of responsibility of playing music the way that he would like it. So that's been kind of interesting. And I'm so excited to hear Joe talking about social justice. I think it's so important. And I think that, you know, as our world gets, you know, smaller and, you know, the income gaps close, unfortunately, or, you know, hopefully will close, or at least income disparity, I guess, widens, I should say. We just created a community music school about a year and a half ago. It's awesome. It offers private music lessons to any student in middle school, high school, that you know, doesn't have the means to get private lessons. And so, you know, for us, this community music school is really kind of an important way for us to reach out to our community and see if we can make it better. And so for us, it's been a wonderful investment. Our own students are the instructors, and so they get to give back. And to see these kids, you know, learn and grow and play solo music and play orchestral music and stuff like that has been really cool, especially since I don't really work with young children as much as I would like to anymore. Seeing these middle school kids and high school kids, like, every week is really fun. So
you guys are doing some really powerful things. This is really cool. This is really, really cool. I love to hear about the social justice thing, the community music school. I mean, it's just remarkable. Wow.
We're pretty lucky, so.
Well, this is great. Well, guys, your interview has been fabulous. I can't thank you enough for your time. I know we went a little bit longer than I expected, and I thank you for your time, and I look forward to sort of getting to work on this. It's my project for next week to dive right in and type up the script and get everything going, so I will share it with you just as soon as I can.
I really appreciate you including us, man. It's a privilege. It's an honor. It's awesome.
I'm glad to talk to like minds, and I've been, I don't know about you guys, the beginning of the semester, swimming and sort of drowning the last few days, but this this conversation has jump-started my batteries. I'm really excited. Thank you.
Yeah, and Eric, we don't talk enough, so this has been nice.
I know, it's true.
That's great. That darn time change. Well, thank you.
It takes takes Trey to bring us together. So thank you, Trey.
Well, great. Well, I'll be in touch with both of you soon, and I look forward to chatting with you more again soon.
Thanks, man. We'll talk to you later.
Thanks again, guys.
Much, Trey.
We'll see ya.
Ciao.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.